My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. Except that's not really what's happening on this episode. We'll get to that in a second. First, though, let me say, I feel like I always say this on the podcast, but the podcast will return at some point soon. I do get messages between every single season of this show from people saying, it's finished, isn't it? It's never coming back. It is coming back, always. We just take long, luxurious breaks between seasons. Actually, it's just reminded me, I think I've told this story in the podcast before, so forgive me for repeating myself, but I was giving a speech about creating audio recently at this kind of like audio workshop thing, and one of my suggestions, or one of my kind of pillars of the entire thing, was saying, if you are going to publish audio, if you are going to be a podcaster or a radio presenter like I am or whatever, you must do it regularly. You must publish regularly. And as I was saying that, I thought, we're about 6 months into the year and I've barely released 10 episodes of this podcast. So this is not the way to do it, but you know, this is mainly for my personal enjoyment of this podcast and the enjoyment of other Dylan fans. So anyway, the podcast will return for season 8 very, very soon. Meantime, I thought I'd use this interim period to bring you some different episodes. I was doing a Patreon until recently. We had like hundreds and hundreds of subscribers towards the end of the Patreon thing. So thank you so much if you did subscribe. It was a lot of fun bringing you those episodes. Sadly, we had to wind it up because I had a couple of other commissions for work and I didn't have enough time to do the Patreon episodes. But I thought we'd bring you a couple this summer of two of my favourite episodes. Let's start with this. This is a chat with Dara Carville, who is a playwright and screenwriter. I guess in the UK, he's best known for The Bay, which was a show I really got into during lockdown. It's an ITV show, and it's one of those shows that I don't know what lockdown was like with you, but me and my wife just basically spent those months indoors, desperately trying to entertain our daughter, and then in the evenings when she was in bed, just watching endless hours of TV. And The Bay was one of those shows, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. Dara is the writer of that and the showrunner. While we were speaking to him, they were working on season 4, which I think might be filming or just finished filming now. Anyway, that'll be out later in the year, I would assume. But if you haven't checked out The Bay yet, then do so, give it a watch. But the reason why I wanted to get Dara on was because, well, he's a big Dylan fan, obviously. He is a listener to this podcast as well. And also, I really wanted to get a writer's perspective on Bob's work. I don't think I've had that on the show, really. I've spoken to loads of musicians down the years, loads of mega fans, but I really wanted to speak to a writer. And I thought Dara would be a great person to speak to because he's so passionate about Bob. I've heard him speak about Dylan's work before, and I really wanted him to kind of go through lyrics from a writer's perspective. So I asked him to pick his 5 favourite Dylan lyrics, and we chatted around them. As I say, it was an absolute joy to have him on. Go and check out The Bay if you haven't done so already, and enjoy me talking to Dara Carville about Bob Dylan's lyrics. Well, Dara, I always start these by asking the people who are on the other end of the Zoom where they are right now. So where are you and what are you doing right now?
I'm at my desk in my study at home in Lancaster, and just behind me is the window through which I've got a view out over Morecambe Bay. So this is where I watch, this is where I write the show, this is where I write The Bay, and occasionally get stuck and wander over to the window and gaze out at Morecambe to try and get some inspiration. And occasionally it works.
Nice, very nice. I like that you actually are in that context. It feels quite reassuring that you're writing yes, with a bay in front of you.
Absolutely.
So can we say what you're working on?
I'm now working on series 4 of The Bay. We start shooting this summer. So it's a very, very hectic period right now of kind of pulling scripts together, and we're casting and meeting with directors, and I'm executive producer on the show as well. So it used to be I was just, you know, here chained to my desk in my garret, but now there's quite a lot of Zooming and, you know, chatting with people involved in it as well. But it's really exciting. We're so thrilled to be going again, and I'm looking forward to, you know, to getting the team back together.
Yeah, I bet, because it's a big show. I mean, it's getting numbers that you would have been proud of, you know, 10 years ago when there was big audience figures. Were you surprised at that when it first came out?
Yeah, because we had no idea that we were going to get an audience. You know, when you're sort of making something like this, it's before the piece is shown, it's kind of a private process. You're working very, very closely and intensely with your collaborators, with actors and directors and script editors and producers and everyone. But it's kind of this private secret thing that you're making because nobody's seen it. And it's not until it actually is broadcast that it's really completed. It's kind of like writing a play. So I started in theatre and I still think of myself really as a playwright. And it's not until you put the play on and you have an audience there that you really know what's working and what's not. And in a weird way, that's the same with TV, even though, you know, we've obviously finished it by the time it's broadcast and I've seen it, you know, I've seen every episode repeatedly, you know. It's still only when the show actually goes out that you go, oh, right, okay, yes, that works. And that people are connecting with that. And that bit's not quite clear enough and all of that. So, no, we didn't know. So it was thrilling when series one went out that we got an audience and that the audience sort of stayed with us. Because that's the other thing. I mean, I'm sure you're the same yourself. I mean, lots of the time I will watch the first episode of something just to get a flavor of it and then think, right, okay, I've seen it now. And not necessarily come back. And that's often reflected in viewer figures. Very often the episode one is the highest rating, but our show managed to build across the six. So then we were given the nod to go for series two. And series two went out during lockdown. And again, it got an audience and built the audience. So it's fantastic. By the time of series three, sort of feels like we're you know, we have a kind of secure sort of audience who come back to the show. So that's really pleasing. And also all around the world, because as you say, actually it's on BritBox in America. It's just about to go on to BritBox. But it's been sold to 130 different territories, I
Wow.
was heard recently, which is just crazy. So it's been seen all around the world. Yeah, it's thrilling, but slightly mind-boggling.
I bet, yeah. That's when I discovered the show in lockdown. It's funny you should say that because I think everyone kind of had, you know, obviously more time on their hands and they got into various TV shows and actually quite a few ITV shows, which was, you know, kind of a nice thing. And you know, stuff like Quiz and The Bay, I thought were brilliant during lockdown. I guess the only problem is when you've had success, you're sort of in, it's almost like you've made your bringing it all back home. And now people are starting to think, well, what's next? Like, what's he going to do next? Do you feel that pressure?
Yeah, and I mean it is a pressure, and you, I suppose this is kind of Bob related in a way. Not that I'm comparing myself for a moment, but you want to build on things, but you don't want to repeat yourself, you know. So it's kind of that's always the challenge, you know. What else can we do with this? What other different kinds of stories can we tell? How can we do things differently? You know, one thing we're, you know, when we're talking about series four now. We're occasionally coming up against, ah, but we did that in series two, or that's a bit like series one, that idea in series one. So we're having to kind of be really rigorous about not repeating ourselves, while at the same time, it's the same show. So, you know, inevitably there are certain kind of elements and certain tropes that are sort of built in. So we're trying to, we're always trying to make it new, even though it is a continuation of the same thing.
Yeah, I know you sort of half joked there, but does Dylan have an influence on you as a writer? I mean, obviously as a person you're a big fan, but as a writer, do you find yourself maybe not taking bits from him, but is he an influence in that area?
Yeah, I think the reason I got into Bob in the first place was because of the words, really. Because I loved his lyrics so much, and we're going to be talking about lyrics today. I mean, it wasn't just the words. I obviously loved the sound of his voice. I loved the music. But it was the wordiness that I really connected with, the sort of abundance of his words. And I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of writers are really into Dylan. And I mean, it's no coincidence that there's such great writing about Dylan. It's because he appeals to people who are also drawn to language and to storytelling and to character and dialogue and all of those things, because that's all there in the work. And it's a bit more sort of front and center in Dylan's work than many other musicians. So I do, I mean, I can't, you know, necessarily point at something in, you know, a play or screenplay that I've written that, you know, comes from Bob. I'm very, very tempted to put Henry Porter into a show.
Yeah, a character called Henry Porter.
Yeah, I very nearly did that, actually. And then I thought, no, there's going to be Bob fans out there watching who kind of go, ah, I see what you're doing. So I don't necessarily take specific things out, but I'm just constantly absorbed in Dylan's language, so I'm sure it must sort of creep in somewhere.
Yeah, I completely see what you mean. I mean, I before I listened to Bob, I paid attention to lyrics, but I didn't realise lyrics could affect you in that sort of way. It was just such a kind of awakening when I heard some of his music and especially obviously the words within that. From your point of view, though, I mean, the main reason why I wanted to speak to you is because I really want to talk to a professional who can cast their eye on Dylan's work from a obviously professional point of view. I've spoken about on the podcast before about how his storytelling was kind of often perhaps not the best in some songs. I mean, there's that famous quote from Jax Levy when they're working on Desire saying that Bob couldn't really do storytelling songs in terms of like it's a linear narrative. And I found that quote kind of fascinating because I sort of agreed. But I mean, well, first of all, do you agree with that quote? And secondly, do you kind of feel like that's the magic of it? It's not linear, and that's the kind of magic behind his songs?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he's a brilliant storyteller, but I just don't think he's a very traditional storyteller. I mean, the quote that always jumps to my mind when I think about him and story is the famous thing that Jean-Luc Godard said. Someone said, films should have a beginning, a middle and an end. And he said, yes, but not necessarily in that order. And that feels very much like what Dylan does. It's never going to be a traditional beginning, middle and end with the kind of setup and payoff. He's not a tidy, polished writer in that sense. And I don't think he's actually interested in that. But there are absolutely story songs in the work. I mean, the stuff he did with Jacques Levy is a case in point. But I mean, a song we're going to be talking about, like Brownsville Girl, is a story song, but it's not a linear beginning, middle and end story song. But it's absolutely full of character and drive and, you know, a sort of cinematic landscape. I mean, it's absolutely an epic piece of narrative, but it's not necessarily one that goes from A to B in a traditional way. I don't think he's interested in that. And there are all sorts of different kinds of story songs in Dylan. We think of, Hattie Carroll is a story song. Mm. And it's a beautifully told story. So it's not that he just doesn't have the control to do it. I think a lot of the time it just doesn't serve what he's interested in. Hurricane's a story song. So he can do it if he chooses to, but I think he's usually more interested in other things. But he'll draw on storytelling as part of, you know, his arsenal.
Yeah, I think those songs you mentioned are quite funny because they are, I guess, you know, despite what Levy says, they are pretty much linear tales. I mean, they are accounts, not true accounts, we're told, but they are accounts of, yes, of something that happened.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Levy had some, this has been debated recently, I know, in fact, in the courts, I believe, about how much...
Yeah.
I'm sure he did because they collaborated, and we're also going to talk about, you know, back to Brownsville Girl again. That was a collaboration with Sam Shepard. So he's also working with other writers. There was also that the sort of abandoned play he worked on with Archibald MacLeish back in the sort of early 70s. So he does seem to be drawn to working with playwrights, particularly, I mean, MacLeish, Levy, Shepard. He's interested in that, and clearly he's very interested in film. Film is a kind of constant theme in the writing. And of course, he's had his own largely unsatisfying dalliances.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about them, yeah. But before we move on to that, I mean, those two songs you mentioned, they are story songs. Is there anything kind of from your point of view about them that makes them so good? Because story songs usually get quite hollow quite quickly, and they're, you know, you've heard the story and that's it. You know, that's the song and it's done and dusted. But with Hurricane and Hattie Carroll especially, actually, they're kind of still very interesting. And I don't know if it's just his wordplay or that we're just such big Dylan fans that he can do no wrong in our eyes. But I don't know quite what it is about them that rewards you on repeat listens, despite the fact you already know the story.
I mean, I think they're both stories about sort of social injustice, and they both build towards a kind of challenge to the listener to do something about this. So there is a kind of narrative aspect to there. There's kind of songs that open up and kind of turn the spotlight on you as a listener, and that's very cleverly done. I'd have to kind of look at them again to see. I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but I think in Hattie Carroll, you know, it sort of starts, it's not linear again, it sort of starts with a murder, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, again, a tradition beginning, middle and end would kind of set everything up and build to the murder and the aftermath. I don't think that's what he does, but I'd need to look at it again.
Yeah, no, totally. Actually, I think, yeah, you're right. It isn't actually as linear as you think. You mentioned about the kind of the sort of dalliance he's had with film and TV. I mean, he famously wanted to make a slapstick comedy for HBO, which, you know, sadly never happened, which I think we're all disappointed.
No, thank God that never happened.
But I was curious to ask you, I mean, you're probably in the best position to answer this question out of anyone I've spoken to about Dylan, but why do you think he's clearly a good writer, but it doesn't quite seem to work with any other writing project in terms of, I'm talking about his films and that area of things? Is it just a different discipline?
It is a different discipline. And I mean, it's in the same way, he's obviously very interested in acting. Again, you know, Brownsville Girl turns on his love of Gregory Peck, or the narrator's love of Gregory Peck. And there's lots of movie stars in, you know, in his work from the beginning, but he himself is an absolutely terrible actor. I just don't think that these are things he's obviously passionate about, but they're not where his talents lie. But everything that he brings into the music from the world of drama and storytelling and acting, that's really where it bears fruit. When he tries to kind of go outside of that and, you know, write his own film or something, whether it's Ronaldo and Clara or the more recent terrible one, which the name escapes me.
Master Anonymous.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there's often very interesting things in there, and you can very much see the same writer who wrote, you know, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall also wrote this. There's similarly kind of apocalyptic imagery, the concerns are all there, but I, you know, he just doesn't have that. Maybe it's a thing about a discipline, you know, as a storyteller, but it doesn't really work.
No, yeah, I think, yeah, clearly it doesn't work. I mean, it's not just like he's tried once and failed. It's multiple times at this stage.
Yeah, and I've seen them all, you know, Hearts of Fire. I know he didn't write that, but I mean, I've sat through those things. So
I was half wondering if you were going to turn around and say, actually, the script writing's really good. But from a professional, we can all now 100% say it's not the best.
Yeah, I don't think so, I'm afraid.
Well, I asked you to come up with some kind of song choices to chat about in terms of lyrics, and you've come up with some brilliant songs. We can rattle through them now if you like. The first one is a classic, and it's Hard Rain, which is you know, it's such an iconic song. Why did this kind of catch your ear above some of the other early songs?
Well, I suppose I was just wanted to think about songs that would really define what is special about Dylan. It was that book that came out recently, Why Dylan Matters. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking about, you know, if you were to suggest, you know, five or half a dozen songs that were uniquely Dylan, that no one else could have written, that show what he brings to this art form, what would those songs be? And I wanted to look at ones that were where the lyric does a lot of the heavy lifting, if you see what I mean. So Hard Rain's Gonna Fall is certainly one of those. It's one of those epic visionary songs from the relatively early period. I mean, there's others I could have chosen. I could have gone with Gates of Eden or It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding. Mm-hmm. But I suppose it's partly because of what's happening in the world right now that my mind went to Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. I mean, as we're speaking, war is raging in Ukraine, and Putin has put the nuclear option on the table. And there's a kind of context to this song from 1962 that suddenly feels horribly topical again. But also, I mean, so he first performed this in September 1962, so a month or so before the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it's not directly inspired by the Cuban Missile Crisis, although obviously that whole kind of Cold War concern and that sort of atmosphere is in the song. And then he records it in December. Now, I'm a massive Beatles fan, but when he was doing Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, this extraordinary, epic, visionary poem, the Beatles were making Love Me Do. And the Beatles were still writing that kind of very simple, direct pop song. And across the Atlantic, Dylan was writing something of this complexity and ambition. Now, that's not dissing the Beatles at all. I absolutely revere everything the Beatles did. It's just to say nobody else was doing what Dylan was doing. Nobody else was at the kind of level of clarity and ambition and sort of visionary storytelling. So, I mean, I think it's the perfect example of that, that era. It does a lot of sort of classic Dylan things. It's, you know, we know it's based on a child ballad, Lord Randall. Mm. It does that Dylan thing or that folk tradition thing of taking the old and repurposing it and refashioning it and making something absolutely new out of it. He said in an interview around the time that he thought of that song as every line in the song being the opening line of a song he wouldn't have time to write. I think this was because, you know, of Cuba and what was happening in the world, and there's a kind of sense of imminent apocalypse. That, again, is a theme that runs right through Dylan's work. But I love that idea of every line in this song could be the beginning of another song. And it does feel like that. I mean, if you look at individual lines in there, it's, you know, they could all be sort of titles. They could all, you know, open up other songs. It's a long song, of course, as many of these ones I've chosen are. And it's really, I think that's another thing that I'm intrigued about with Bob Dylan is his abundance as a writer. So many of the songs are long, and they're kind of torrents of language. You probably tell from my accent, I'm an Irish writer, and, you know, two of my kind of touchstones are James Joyce and Samuel Beckett, and they're kind of opposites as writers, because Joyce is all about abundance and, you know, moreness, and Beckett is all about stripping things back and doing less, and he used this term lessness. Well, Dylan is very much on the Joycean side of that divide as a writer. You know, it's really, he's got an incredible sort of fecundity, and there's a richness and abundance to the writing that, you know, is here in evidence in Hard Rain. I mean, when the Nobel Prize Committee, when they awarded the prize to Dylan, they said something like, there was a citation that was, you know, he has added new, you know, something like poetic dimensions to the tradition of American song. And when they said that, they could almost have been talking about this song. I mean, you could take this song as an example and just say, nobody wrote a song like this before. Nobody else was writing songs like this. The Beatles were doing Love Me Do. Mm. This is something completely, completely new. So for all of those reasons, I love it. I mean, the one thing I suppose to say, it's not to criticize it, but there's a faint air of finger pointiness to this song, which is something he would later react against, and he famously had a row with Phil Oakes about finger pointing songs and the idea, you know, you're just a journalist.
You're just a journalist, yeah.
Yeah,
a great that's put a down.
Terrible insult from Bob Dylan. So I actually, in some ways, I almost prefer the kind of rollicking Rolling Thunder version of the song. Much as I love and revere the original, because it's very austere and it's stripped down and it's, you know, Bob kind of in black and white singing a folk song with a, you know, strumming his acoustic guitar. Whereas with Rolling Thunder, it's done as a big kind of show-stopping rock and roll song. But the song still survives in the same way, you know, when Brian Ferry did that, you know, slightly arch sort of pop version of it. The song itself is just sort of indestructible. You sort of do anything with it and it will still work.
Yeah, that's a sign of a good song, that no matter kind of what medium it comes in, it's still really good. Yes, I love what you said there about its length, and I've always found this song in particular fascinating, that it is fairly long and it is just him and an acoustic guitar, and it for some reason it doesn't ever seem to drag, and everything about it shouldn't work really. It's length and like you say, it's you know, every line feels like line of a new song, and I think it's just an amazing achievement for him right at the start of his career. It's quite incredible, and I completely agree what you said about with the Beatles, and we were speaking about Get Back just before we started, and we both loved Get Back, the Beatles documentary. Thought it was brilliant. In fact, you are drinking this very second out of a Get Back mug, and I mean, we really loved it. I thought it was a brilliant documentary and fascinating to see. But I couldn't believe at one point they were just sort of writing down lyrics, like in the moment going, well, does this rhyme with this? And should we just throw that in there? And oh, this sounds a bit better. And I'm sure that happens with Dylan sometimes. You know, you can hear some rhymes where he's just literally gone, what rhymes with shoe? I'll just throw something else in.
Yeah.
But the Beatles...
Way you walk, I love the way you talk.
Yeah, yeah. But with the Beatles, it seemed kind of so... such an afterthought, the lyrics, and again, we're not trashing the Beatles. They're, you know, they are incredible, obviously, but Dylan just felt a whole world away from what was going on in Get Back, and obviously that's a little bit later than this, but
I think so. One of the things I thought was fascinating in Get Back, and this isn't going off on a tangent, I hope, is they kept talking about things singing well. You know, when they're talking about the song Get Back and they're looking for names for the characters, I think before they arrive on, you know, Loretta Martin, and they're trying different options, and I think it's Paul who says it's got to sing well, and John at another point is talking about it needs to be all like B's and P's. So in other words, it's the sound that's dictating things, and it's the singability, the musicality of the language is almost more important than meaning. And I think there is a lot of that in Dylan too. You know, here and there, there are songs where you kind of think this is really driven by sound rather than meaning. I mean, at its best, I think both things work together absolutely brilliantly. And in A Hard Rain, I think it's a perfect example of that. But I think he is... he's not scared he's not scared of things not really being obvious and meaning something very clear. I mean, even in this song, a line like, I saw a white ladder all covered it with water. Now, most of the lines in A Hard Rain, you can see what he's talking about very clearly. He's talking about a kind of world turned upside down. You know, it's, I met a young woman whose body was burning, you know, that sort of prophetic almost of that awful image of the young woman in a napalm attack in Vietnam from years after this song. But, you know, most of these lines are talking about this kind of apocalyptic imagery. But I don't really know what "I saw a white ladder all covered in water" means, nor does it worry me. In fact, it makes the song much stronger, because it's not just a catalogue of horrors. There are also these kind of strange, mysterious lines in there, which just give the song, I suppose it, take it away from that potential for finger pointing or for, you know, being a bit on the nose or stating the obvious. I think that all helps the song open up. It's also really interesting to me that it's a dialogue. So going back to that storytelling or drama element in Dylan, this is a conversation, and it seems to be a conversation, if you take it literally, between a mother and a son, or a father and a son, perhaps. But I've always thought of it as being a mother and a son. And she asks a series of questions. Where have you been? What did you see? What did you hear? Who did you meet? What will you do? And there's a build to those questions towards that, what will you do, that enables then the other character, who is the blue-eyed son, to give an account of what he's seen and heard and who he's met, and then to end on a sort of declaration of intent. You know, what are you going to do about it? Well, I'm going to get out there. I'm going to bear witness. I'm going to tell the story. I'm going to sing the songs. I'll know my song well before I start singing. So there's a beautiful build to it, which means that it never becomes repetitive. You know, it sort of almost should feel repetitive, because it's just this image after image after image. It's a very fixed pattern. But that pattern breathes and builds and sort of brings us somewhere else by the end. And I think that's why it works so beautifully.
Yeah, I've never thought of it in that context, really. Yeah, that makes perfect sense, though. And I completely agree with what you said about some of the images being a little bit off the beaten track, or maybe not what you'd expect. And I think that it helps to make his more finger-pointing songs less on the nose. I think if they were all completely on the nose, it would almost be like you're being preached at, and as a listener, that's quite a turn off. But I think, especially as we get into sort of bringing it all back home territory, the images become stranger and stranger, and that only aids the protest element of them. Even a song like Hattie Carroll, I mean, there's an amazing analysis of it from Christopher Ricks, who is an academic. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he analyzes sort of classic poetry, and he goes through that song and goes through the lines, and it's fascinating what he says about it, because actually when you do sit down and look at it, there's some not strange images, but there's some really great ways of describing the scene that aren't perhaps the way you would automatically describe them. And I think he's so good at that. And like you say, I think that appears a lot in A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, almost subtly. It appears a hell of a lot in your second choice as well. In fact, the song of your second choice is possibly one of the weirdest songs in his back catalogue. I mean, it's another epic. It's Desolation Row. And I've got so many favourite lines in this song. But, why did this become your second choice?
Well, It was because I was thinking about Hard Rain, and then this one feels like it builds on that achievement. And it sort of feels to me like he was conscious of this danger of finger pointing, and that he wanted to move away from that. And so this, it's another kind of visionary, surreal sort of epic, but it doesn't have the... it doesn't quite have that element of reportage and topicality that Hard Rain does. But I still think this is, I do always think of this as being a protest song. Mm. It's just a very different kind of protest song. It's a protest song that kind of works through surreal imagery, sort of brimming with these extraordinary images and ideas and characters. But the opening line, famously, they're selling postcards of the hanging. Now, we know that this refers to an actual hanging that happened in 1920 in Duluth, where Dylan is from. Three circus workers, young black men, were hanged in the town square. And postcards were made of this lynching and were sold. And this is obviously a story that he's absorbed from his hometown, perhaps from his family. And so that being the opening line, I know it's a bit coded, but that suggests that we are in a world of protest. But from there, obviously, it goes into stranger and stranger and more. I think the word I always use for this when I'm thinking about it is carnivalesque. Mm. It's no coincidence that it mentions a carnival. There is a carnival happening on Desolation Row, and that sort of literary idea of the carnivalesque, I think, is quite an interesting one to apply to the Dylan of this particular time, this sort of mid-60s, you know, sort of acid, I don't mean in a drug sense, but in a kind of, you know, the sort of cynical, bitter eye of Dylan of that kind of mid-60s period. There is a kind of carnivalesque element to all of that. With Desolation Row, strangely, my favourite line isn't in the song because I think my favourite version of Desolation Row is actually the one that came out a few years ago on one of the bootleg collections. It's the one where Al Kooper plays an amazing like proto Velvet Underground guitar. And the lyrics are just ever so slightly different. And it includes my favorite line, which is, "They're force feeding Casanova the boiled guts of birds," which I just absolutely adore. And I heard that many years after I heard the original, and I love the original, especially Charlie McCoy's amazing guitar work.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a shame that we lost the boiled guts of birds. It's such a fantastic image. And it changed to the slightly, you know, more low-key and slightly disappointing, "They're spoon-feeding Casanova to get him to feel more assured."
Yeah, it's
Boiled guts of birds is much, much better than that. Come on, Bob.
giving him notes already. I love it.
Yes. Yeah. But yes, I mean, I absolutely love this song. Again, it's a really long one. It's another sort of 11 minutes, I think. There's an interesting turn in it. Right at the end, after the harmonica break, suddenly the singer of the song or the speaker of the song addresses someone else directly, which hasn't happened before. We've heard, I mentioned at the top of the song, something about Lady and I. Lady and I look out tonight on Desolation Row. So there's a narrator and there's someone with him who he calls Lady. But then towards the end of the song, he changes mode and starts to address someone else. He says, "Yes, I received your letter yesterday about the time the doorknob broke. When you asked me how I was doing, was that some kind of joke? All these people that you mentioned, yes, I know them, they're quite lame. I had to rearrange their faces and give them all another name." And what I love about that, I mean, it's just fantastic lyrics, but I love the drama of the shift there to, we've been going through this kind of epic, carnivalesque, surreal world of, you know, the Phantom of the Opera and Casanova and Ophelia and Dr. Filth and all of that. This very strange world, like something out of a George Grosz painting or something like that. But now suddenly we're just talking directly to someone else. "I received your letter yesterday." And there's clearly some bitterness there. There's something has gone wrong. Feels like we're talking about a breakup or some kind of disillusionment. So that shift to the personal, again, just adds another dimension to this song. So I think it does have elements of protest song, but there's also something very deeply personal that comes in right at the end with that shift. And then, "I had to rearrange their faces and give them all another name." I wonder, is that the song reflecting on itself? Is he saying, what I have been doing in this song is writing about those people who you mentioned, but I've had to change them all around and give them another name?
Yeah, because you do get that kind of carnival of strange characters.
We do. And I wonder, is he talking about something else, something more personal? I wonder, in a way, is this a little bit like a Positively Fourth Street kind of dig at the people he's left behind, the people who are maybe bitter with him for moving on? I wonder, I mean, I don't know, and we probably never will know, but I just love the just that added shift at the end that sort of again opens the song out. It makes it more personal, but also there's a kind of self-reflexive quality to that. And he does that in other songs where we'll go on a long journey and then he'll bring it back to the song itself.
Yeah, sort of a reveal at the end, if you like.
Yeah, he does that actually in very recently in Murder Most Foul, which obviously ends with Play Murder Most Foul. So he includes the very song he is singing and writing in this great, you know, epic list of songs that piece sort of builds through. It's something that he's got form there, but I think that's at work in Desolation Row. I think it's kind of at work in Hard Rain's Gonna Fall as well, because by the end the narrator of the song, you know, one of the two characters is saying, I'm going to bear witness, I'm going to sing my song. And this is the song I'm singing implicitly. So there is a kind of postmodern reflexive thing going on there, I think.
Yeah, I think he does. He loves a kind of good third act sometimes. I mean, even in the song like Black Diamond Bay, where it's very unsubtle that there's this major kind of shift in the big kind of like punchline, if you like. Yeah, I completely agree what you said about the protest song. And I feel like there's lots of protest songs, you know, on those three albums that we go through, from Bringing It All Back Home to Blonde on Blonde, but they're just shrouded in other stuff to kind of almost disguise them, especially, you know, like Tombstone Blues, where we talk about, you know, the president, and there's that amazing line about the sun's not yellow, it's chicken. So yeah, I think that's going on quite a lot, and we maybe miss it a little bit more. I love that you highlighted that my favourite line in the whole song of Desolation Row, when you say, when you asked how I was doing, was that some kind of joke, which I think is... It's a profound line, but it's also really funny at the same time, because it's, you know, it's him saying, like, you clearly are high mistake. Look at me. I'm here with all these people. Yeah. So, yeah, I just think
it's interesting, though, because that the line that sets that up about the time the doorknob broke is such a daft line. Yeah. And it's obviously one of those, like we were talking about earlier, sometimes, you just reach for a rhyme, but you can allow that in a song like this, because the song is so eccentric and kind of full of mad invention, but also it's also very funny. And, you know, it's one of the things to say about Dylan, you know, I've talked about his abundance, but he's one of the funniest writers. And hopefully we'll see that with some of these other songs as well, but I don't think that's talked about enough, really. It's not something that's so a lot of the tone of sort of Dylan criticism tends to be, you know, very serious and chin stroking, but actually a lot of the tone of Dylan's work is very, very funny, laugh out loud funny in places.
Yeah, definitely. I think, as you say, that's often glossed over. Well, the next song isn't so funny. Blind Willie McTell is our next song.
Yes,
not a laugh a minute, but
not a ridiculous,
but a complicated song. I mean, for me, it's a song that it's just got so much in it. I mean, slavery, sort of land displacement and early America. Obviously, Willie McTell himself, there's a biblical quote. There's a nod to old folk songs in it. What do you love about Blind Willie McTell?
Absolutely everything. I think it's one of his great achievements, and it's still galling, even all of these years later, that he didn't include it on Infidels, and that it was actually years before we got to hear it. But then it's one of the highlights of that amazing initial three-volume set of the bootleg recordings. It's just a really, really beautiful song. And one of the reasons I love it so much, I suppose, I mean, I could just talk forever about why I love it, but one of the reasons is because it was recorded in 1983, and Dylan had a terrible 80s by, you know, common, you know, opinion, common consent, I guess. And, you know, it's hard to argue with that. He did some bafflingly bad work. And he was clearly quite unhappy. And he writes about that himself in Chronicles. It was a kind of lost time for him, as it was for other people of his vintage. You know, if you look at the work that, you know, Neil Young was doing in the 80s, or, you know, Paul McCartney, or, you know, a lot of the people who started, who were born of the kind of idealism and sort of white hot, you know, energy of the 60s, by the 80s and Reaganomics and Thatcherism, they're a bit kind of lost.
Yeah, it wasn't their decade. It was the opposite of everything.
Well, absolutely. And you get those records like Empire Burlesque, where you've got this awful, you know, production. And he was sort of really struggling to work out what his place in the world was. And out of that, though, comes this amazing song, and also Brownsville Girl a little bit later, which we'll also talk about. So it's partly that. It's partly just because it's a jewel in his career at a time when, you know, at a sort of a fallow period in his writing life. I also think it's a protest song. You know, you know, 1983, you are in the world of Reaganomics, and you're still in the Cold War, and it's a kind of hard, it's a bitter time. It certainly was here as well in the UK. And I think he is writing a protest, a sort of coded protest song. Maybe that's just what I want him to be writing, but you can certainly read it as a protest.
Yeah, I definitely think there's lots of protest.
Look at the state of the world we have made, and we don't even have anyone who can put it into words and put it into song, except the song itself is proving that that is not true, because actually there is someone who can sing blues like Blind Willie McTell, and it's the Bob Dylan who is singing this song. It's fantastic. It's full of vivid imagery, you know, from the arrow on the doorpost. On, I think, again, every line, not necessarily every line could be the first line of another song, but maybe, but every line is really vivid and clear. There's no filler here. In fact, actually, countering what I said earlier about abundance, this is one of his more economical songs. It really feels like he's condensed things down here. I think it's perfect.
Yeah, I think it's actually, I've never even thought of it in its context of it being an 80s song, but I think, you know, when you look at lines like, well, God is in his heaven and we all want what's his, but power and greed and corruptible seed, that feels like a very 80s kind of protest against what was going on at that point. So yeah, I can completely see that. And I love the fact that he's just, you know, he just turned around and went, well, the song's not good enough to go on Infidels, so let's not release it for another, you know, decade.
Crazy. The other thing to say about it, I guess, which connects it back to what I was saying at the start about Hard Rain, is that, again, it does that folk tradition thing of taking something old and making something entirely new out of it, because it's not just a reflection about Blind Willie McTell, the great Georgia blues singer, but it also, as I understand it, it sort of builds on the melody of a song called St. James Infirmary, an old folk song. Mm,
which he sort of mentions at the end.
Yes, that's what I love. I love that little reference at the end. I'm gazing out the window of the St. James Hotel. I love that kind of intertextual relationship that's going on there. There's also a brilliant book that I should mention about Blind Willie McTell. I don't know if you've read it, by Michael Gray, who I think is the greatest writer about Bob Dylan, but also wrote a fantastic book about Blind Willie McTell called Hand Me My Travelling Shoes, which I heartily recommend.
Very nice. Yeah, again, a kind of a reveal in the final moments of that song. Let's stay in the 80s, shall we, and move on to Brownsville Girl, which is sort of the one shining light on Knocked Out Loaded. It's another epic, and as you mentioned earlier, a song that is in love with film, and particularly Gregory Peck, who is a big kind of Dylan, he's a hero of Dylan's. this is such a vast song, and it's not, you know, in a classic Dylan style, it's not just existing in just this song. You know, there's New Danville Girl as well, and you know, it's kind of living, breathing piece of art, if you like. It seems to never stop. From a writer's point of view, I mean, is this perhaps your favourite song in terms of Dylan's writing? Because it sort of feels like it's one of those songs that is a real kind of writer's favourite, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favourite songs, full stop. And I mean, the fact that it's a collaboration between two of my favourite writers, you know, it's sort of it blows my mind that this even exists. I love Sam Shepard's players, and I love Dylan's music. So the notion of them coming together is extraordinary. But the fact that they produce something as brilliant as this, because often those sort of dream collaborations that you think, oh, that would be absolutely magical, sort of don't really turn out to work that well. But this one absolutely does. And you have a real sense of collaboration here. There's a real sense of two creative artists at the peak of their powers bouncing ideas off each other. I know both of their writing really well, but at the same time, I'm not sure I could tell you line by line who wrote what. Mm. It's a very organic whole, but you can still feel that kind of the intensity of that collaborative conversation going on. I mean, there's so many lines that I love in this, but if there's an original thought out there, I could use it right now. Yeah. Feels almost like something that was said in the room as they were writing it, you know, maybe running a bit dry and then going, oh yeah, I'll stick that in. But it's just, it's so fantastic. It's a wonderful reflection on movies and memory as a kind of movie that we run through in our own minds as we think back on our lives and sort of paths our lives have taken. Again, it's a kind of there's a dialogue, there's a you in here, and it's not always quite clear. It's very often with Dylan, it's not always clear who the I is and who the you is. I mean, I assume the you is the Brownsville girl, who it feels like is the kind of one who got away, and that there's a kind of memory of having been with this extraordinary person in the past, and then there's someone you're with now who's not her. I think this is an amazing achievement. And again, the fact that it came out in 86 or whenever it was, at a really bad time for Dylan's, no, at a bad time for Dylan fans, I have to say, because I was already one at that point. And
oh, living through that time must have been awful.
It was quite. Yeah, I have suffered. You know, it was difficult because you always had the 60s and sort of mid 70s masterpieces kind of referred to, and everything after felt like such a falling away. And I always sort of kept the faith. I always knew there's going to be a moment when, because this happened, I remember this happened with Lou Reed when, because he had a kind of dodgy 80s as well. And then his album New York came out, and then suddenly everybody was going, this is the best record he's done for years. I've always loved Lou Reed and so on. And I always sort of felt that's going to happen with Dylan. And then it sort of did with Oh Mercy. And then things went a bit wobbly again. But I think since Time Out of Mind, he really has been back.
An amazing end to his career. And I think we're so lucky, because the worst thing for him would be to fade out and start releasing, you know, an endless amount of folk covers albums and slide into irrelevance. But you know, I mean, especially the Rough and Rowdy Ways record. I mean, what a treat to have such a good record at this point of his career.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, the last song I've chosen is Not Dark Yet. But I could have chosen, and I suppose for me that represents late Dylan, but I suppose the reality is that song is now 20 or 25 years old. And actually we've had, again, this word abundance. We've had this great abundance of new work from him since then, and there are lots of songs in that late period Dylan that I could have chosen a song like Mississippi or High Water, or really almost anything off Rough and Rowdy Wes. I think he's really on form.
As you say, there's so many great songs from this era to pick from.
Well, I remember when Time Out of Mind came out, and as I said, I'd been a Dylan fan through the low point through the 80s and into the 90s, and I'd sort of stuck with him and was often very disappointed, sometimes even slightly embarrassed, but always felt, no, there's great, you know, great work is going to, you know, it's going to happen. You know, we had Oh Mercy, which was a high point, and there's lots to love in those 90s folk records as well. But Time Out of Mind absolutely blew me away, and Not Dark Yet in particular. I remember the first time hearing that and just realizing what he was doing, that he was actually writing about aging and time passing and losing your bearings and facing the end. And I can't really think of another songwriter who's doing that. I mean, it's really, if you think about his peers, you know, his 60s contemporaries, it's hard to imagine, you know, Mick Jagger writing a song like Not Dark Yet. So it's actually hard to imagine McCartney either.
Yeah, I don't, it's
or,
not
or,
quite
or
so.
Brian Wilson, or any of them really committing to writing about getting older in this way. And so it's that, and it's such a kind of clear-sighted, I mean, it's bitter, but it's very clear-sighted, this song. And again, there's that shift to the personal, like in Desolation Row, there's the moment where he goes, she wrote me a letter and she wrote it so fine, she put down in writing what was on her mind. So again, it's not just an apocalyptic kind of vision, it's deeply personal. I think it's one of his most beautiful songs, one of his most beautiful recordings. And I mean, it's a song that I can set up, alongside the great work of his youth when he was this incredible young firebrand. And I could, you know, put Hard Rain's on and then, you know, segue into Not Dark Yet. And I think, I mean, that's a lifetime, but it's the same level of achievement, the same clarity and intensity. I love this song.
Yeah, strange. It's almost like he's sort of half welcoming death. He's sort of kind of made his peace almost, which, you know, is an amazing kind of thing to write about. But also I love the fact he's been singing about aging and the end for about almost 30 years. So it's like...
It's true. And actually, on the very first album, he sounded like an old man,
exactly,
fixing to die.
So it shouldn't be too much of a surprise that he's doing it so well, because he's been ready for it his whole life.
Yeah, it's true. It does fit him.
But yeah, like I say, it's so good. We've had this amazing kind of, you know, third act to his career. Dara, there are some amazing choices in there, so thank you so much for them. Thank you so much for giving us an insight into Dylan's work from a professional writer's point of view. We look forward to season 4 of The Bay and the inevitable Dylan references you have to slip into it. So thank you very much for joining us. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. It's been an honour.
That's it for my chat with Dara. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Dara for coming on. Like I was saying earlier, you can check out The Bay right now. Seasons 1 to 3 are out. They're on BritBox in America, and they're also on ITV and the ITV Hub in the United Kingdom. That's it for this special little episode. There'll be another one coming out later in the summer, and then we'll get to season 8 of the podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Take care of yourself, and I'll see you down the road.